This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Welcome to Go Home in a Box, your podcast source for all things genre films from the VHS era. My name is Chris Jordan, one of your grateful co-hosts, and we welcome you after a one-week hiatus. I want to give a shout-out to Mrs. Jordan in her recovery from surgery. She's doing well, and that would be the reason why we took a week off. Couldn't leave her in the lurch like that, not even for you, Joel. So.
See, now I'm feeling slighted.
Well, you know, she happens to be much better looking than you, so I think we got a fair trade there.
Oh, that's just a blatant lie, because there's no one better looking than me. But
oh my goodness,
she is your wife. You kind of have to say that. Understandable.
Oh, where do I go from there? Oh, well. Hey, you can find me online at RetroMovieNerd.com, where last week I reviewed Star Trek Generations from 1994. It was supposed to be the epic first meeting of Captains Kirk and Picard, and unfortunately, it needed a better story. But without giving too much away, you can find that review on RetroMovieNerd.com. And this week, I will have a review of the 1977 action comedy Smokey and the Bandit, starring Burt Reynolds and the late, great Jackie Gleason. Does it hold up? No, it doesn't hold up.
What?
It's CB in the 70s. You got your Trans Am and your trucker speak, and but it's still dumb, good fun. And you can find that review right now on RetroMovieNerd.com.
I should take the time to say that Chris's views don't represent all of us that go home in a box, because Smokey and the Bandit is life-changing.
Life-changing.
I was going to ask who you sided with in the great Kirk-Picard debate, but now I'm curious. Burt Reynolds or Jackie Gleason?
Jackie Gleason stole it for me.
Agreed.
Very. Yes. Yeah. we can agree on that. So go check out RetroMovieNerd.com for a couple of new reviews for your reading pleasure. And, of course, he's already stated his opinion with me, as always, is Joel LaPuma, the Ayatollah of pop cultura. Joel, how you been the last week?
I've been good. And at Razor Candy at razor-candy.com, you can see my review of the most recent Hudson Horror Show number 15, headlined by Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors, also including Piranha, The Hidden, Frankenhooker, and Slaughterhouse, and a mystery film that I'm obligated not to say because it's Hudson Horror tradition.
Yes, that's good stuff, though, but I'll be checking that out myself.
And Oh, and this week at the Mahoning Drive-In Theater in Pennsylvania, I probably won't be able to attend this one, but they've got an Animals Gone Wild weekend. Two nights of killer animal films. Friday the 23rd, they've got Grizzly, Night of the Lepus, and Day of the Animals. And Saturday the 24th, they've got Squirm, Frogs, and Kingdom of the Spiders.
Oh, my goodness. Oh. How many miles from Texas to Pennsylvania?
Yeah, I'd say it's worth any number of miles.
I'll be broke by the time I get there. I'll stock up on Philly cheesesteaks.
Yeah.
There goes my movie money.
It's a lineup. I mean, the only one I've seen in theater so far is Day of the Animals, which is more than worth it just for Leslie Nielsen's performance.
Yeah, I've got a copy of Kingdom of the Spiders myself. And always a classic. So we might get to talk about We might have a Day of the Animals special here on Go Home in a Box very soon, Joel.
Really neat. I've been dying to talk about the Lost Grizzly 2.
The concert.
Yes.
Isn't that Grizzly 2, the concert?
I think that's the subtitle, yeah. And if I remember, it had a number of young, famous actors in it. And I just don't know what happened to this thing. I know there's some big story behind. I'm sorry. It's at a concert. It's Grizzly 2, the Predator.
Oh, okay.
It was mostly completed, it seems like. Just never released. Early Charlie Sheen and George Clooney appearances.
Interesting. George Clooney. I hope the Grizzly gets him.
Oh, me too.
All right, well, let's head on over to the new release section, Joel, because we have some catching up to do with our week off. We'll start with last week's new releases, and there were some big ones in here, a couple of interesting ones as well. From Kino Lorber, 1985's Runaway Train. With John Voight and Eric Roberts, and we mentioned this back on our Canon two-parter. This is probably one of their best films under the Canon label, and it was nominated for a couple of Academy Awards, and it's definitely worth a look. It's just one of those white-knuckle thrillers, you know, that you just need to check out.
Yeah, absolutely. This is one I've been meaning to see ever since we talked about it in the Canon podcast, because it just the cast is phenomenal. It's got the first appearances of Danny Trejo and Tiny Lister, and the script was based on a original idea by Kurosawa. So.
Yeah, it was a Kurosawa. That's most interesting.
Yeah, so it's just a really interesting moment in film, and Canon's, you know, one successful shot at being a respectable company.
Yeah, and it was a good shot at that. So moving on, we have a collection from Sony called the Undead Collection. It's five vampire-related films, including the original Fright Night, not the remake, thank you, Bram Stoker's Dracula, John Carpenter's Vampires, the highly underrated 30 Days of Night, and something that I'm not familiar with in the Covenant.
If I recall, wasn't that a post-Twilight male beefcake vampires film?
There is a reason why I'm not familiar with it then.
Yeah, actually directed by Rennie Harlan, though, which is interesting. But it's got, I think the only actor in here I'm familiar with is Taylor Kitsch. It was sort of, I guess if you're being generous, you could call it like a modern and Lost Boys-ish thing, but it was, basically just a teeny bopper vampire flick to cash in on the Twilight success.
Yeah, I think this really, you know.
Or actually, they might have been witches or something. I don't know. Like, yeah, this was a witch one. I'm sorry.
Yeah. Well, it's in the Undead Collection, so something in that movie is undead. We'll just have to... Someone will have to watch it on my behalf to find out what it is. I don't know. But all in all, I think that adds up to a pretty decent collection, even if it's 4 out of 5, you know, half-decent films in there. Definitely something that you want to check out, especially if you're, you know, a nut for vampire movies. And there's quite a few of them out there. Moving on, Sony's also got, you know, they've done this before, and they're going to do it again. Ghostbusters 1 and 2 is out on a double feature DVD. And I'm sure that's, many people have probably already got this in their collection.
But there's enough people out there stocking Ecto Cooler, hoarding it, that they could probably afford to buy another one.
The highly elusive Ecto Cooler. Ecto Cooler. My bad. Sorry about that. But, I've never tried it. I'm sure that juice is pretty good.
I remember it being great when I was a kid. I'm not sure it would hold up with, you know, the taste buds of an adult.
Just mix it with some vodka. I'm sure you'll be okay.
I think it's probably better kept in my childhood.
Here's an interesting one, Joel, from 1978, put out by Mondo Macabro. It's Paul Naschy's Inquisition. I'm not familiar with this movie. I'm not sure what you know about this one.
Yeah, I'm not as familiar with Naschy's stuff as I should be. I know this is one of the ones he directed, and I'm almost positive wrote as well. He did write it. He's playing a Witchfinder General in this, I believe, and it's got kind of a star-crossed romance element between him and a witch.
Okay.
Which, I think he actually plays a dual role in this one. If I recall, he's also playing Satan.
Oh, well, interesting.
Let me
ask you, do we have any idea of the quality of this film? Like, does it have a cult following or anything like that?
I mean, Nash is sort of a cottage industry in himself. You never really hear people mention, like, specific Naschy films as much as just Naschy himself. So I would expect this is different enough from, like, you know, his regular werewolf stuff that I think it'd probably be at least be worth a look if you're interested in Naschy. You're just interested in that weird sort of sub scene of Spanish horror back in the 70s and 80s.
Okay. So, definitely probably a niche audience for this film. So, if you're interested, seek out Inquisition from Mondo Macabro. We also have another Arrow video released this week from 1981, Madhouse. This is another film I have not seen, so I cannot make any judgment on it whatsoever, but I'm sure you can, Joel.
Yeah, I've actually seen this one. It's known, like, under a million titles, and When She Was Bad, There Was a Little Girl. It was a video on the Video Nasty List, although I don't remember it being particularly objectionable on content. It's just kind of a vaguely supernatural slasher-ish film. I think there is a, table seated with a bunch of corpses sitting around a table scene. That's probably what got it on the Video Nasty List. But, it's a lot like Happy Birthday to Me, I think. It's directed by, what's his name? Video Asinitis, the dude who did, Beyond the Door, Tentacles, The Visitor.
Okay.
Yeah, no, it's a nice little film. I mean, it's not like, you know, anything particularly exceptional, but, you know, it's a cool little, like, 90-minute horror film.
Okay. And then Shout Factory, releasing on Blu-ray from 1990, the infamous Alienator.
Now,
I've got this on a four-movie collection that I purchased a few years back with stuff like Eliminators and Time Guardian, what can you say about Alienator? Really, Fred Olin Ray and we got like a muscle bound female Terminator type character, except it's very this is another movie. It has a cult following, but I think it has a cult following for the wrong reasons.
You could certainly say it's a movie. Apparently, it's actually sort of a tribute and semi-remake to The Astounding Gia Monster, which is a late 50s sci-fi horror, which I haven't seen. And Fred Olin Ray, if anything, is good. He is extremely knowledgeable student of classic monster movies. If you really want to see Jan Michael Vincent slumming it, like... And of course, PJ Souls has a small, fairly thankless role. She doesn't really get to do much, which is a shame because PJ's great. It's certainly a movie.
This is Jan Michael Vincent, probably 15 years after he was anything serviceable in Hollywood. I mean, he hit some hard times, and I think this is smack dab in the middle of, like, hard time number four for him or something like that.
His career certainly it does have a lot of I mean, this is probably about, what, 4 or 5 years after they did that weird last season of Airwolf with none of the major actors in it. and like barely any helicopter because they actually couldn't afford to do the helicopter. I think it was when Airwolf moved to USA, when USA was still like a very burgeoning network, and they had no budget to make another season of Airwolf, which...
Okay, so you had Airwolf without a helicopter, but it was still called Airwolf?
I think they basically like used whatever stock footage and previous footage from episodes of the series they like had access to. Like I think they might have gotten like Jan Michael Vincent for like the first episode of that season. Like Airwolf blows up and he's in a hospital bed, and like they kill off Ernest Borgnine's character, but it's not him. It's like a stunt double you see walking to the helicopter right before it blows up. It's one of the saddest, like most desperate things you'll ever see. It's wonderful.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to catch up on Airwolf. Surprisingly, I did not check that out as much as I should have in my younger years. But it's on El Rey, and El Rey is good for kitschy cult TV shows like that. So Knight Rider and the Incredible Hulk are on there now. So anyway, yeah, Jan Michael Vincent's in Alienator. That's why we're talking about Airwolf.
Because anything to not talk about Alienator.
Exactly. Let's move on. Still going a little bit deeper here in the new release section, because now we've got new releases coming out this coming week, June the 20th. Kick it off with, of course, a double movie Blu-ray set from Paramount of Airplane and Airplane 2. Not much more to be said about these two movies. I mean, the first one is a comedy classic. The second one, not so much. The second one has the benefit of having William Shatner hamming it up in a hit-and-miss performance. Airplane 2 on Blu-ray. And then from Arrow, a two-disc limited edition Blu-ray from 1970, Dario Argento's The Bird with the Crystal Plumage.
And, it's not my favorite Argento, because it's very early Argento. You can actively, it's more like a traditional giallo. There's some weirdness in it, but it's almost like watching like one of Fellini's early neorealist films. You can feel him straining at the format he's in and wanting to go weirder and bigger with it. So, I mean, there are some nice things. It's definitely worth a look just for the basic, like, just for a basically decent little giallo film. And if you're, like, a big Argento fan, Argento scholar, yeah, seeing that, it's a cool moment in the development of his career.
Yeah, it's probably for, like, those Argento completists that are out there.
Yeah. Yeah, it's not the film you're generally going to choose to watch over Deep Red if you want like an Argento giallo film, but it's worth a look and an occasional viewing.
Okay. Now another one coming out this week from Massacre Video. We talked about this one a little while back, but I think the release was pushed back. It's Hack-O-Lantern from 1988, and I believe this movie went under several different titles, including some Halloween Night, I think, was one of them.
Yeah.
But yeah, they pushed back the release date, and so it's coming out this coming week from Massacre.
Yeah, and it looks like it's in stock on their website currently, so I think it should finally be out. I haven't got a chance to see it yet. It's made the rounds at a few horror shows recently. But nothing I've gotten the chance to actually go see. I mean, despite what you may assume, this is actually shot on film, not one of the weird shot on video late 80s horror films. But it looks like a pretty wonderfully sleazy, stupid film.
Yeah, my kind of movie. Try every effort I can to try and check that out. Also from this week, we got a couple of Shout or Scream releases. first from 1966, we have Island of Terror with Peter Cushing, directed by Mr. Terence Fisher, whose more renowned films are in the Hammer catalog. I've actually seen this one a couple of times, thanks to the Sven Gulli show on MeTV. And it's, you know, it's really a silly, you know, 60s horror film. It was some sci-fi elements. Basically, the creatures in the film just suck the bones out of people, leaving just, like, the fleshy mass, like dropping a coat on the floor, you know? And these things look like turtles with periscopes for heads. It's just really strange-looking creatures, and they're really slow moving. I mean, I believe there is a scene in the movie. You remember that scene in Austin Powers where Austin Powers is on the steamroller and that one guy is standing like 20 feet away screaming like he's about to get run over?
Oh my God, is there a scene like that in this?
There's kind of a scene like that where this creature, you know, is coming for someone and is moving very slowly, and all the person can do there is stand and scream instead of run away.
That's always wonderful, though.
Yeah, but this is from, I guess, the Universal catalog when they were doing, you know, horror films towards the tail end of that whole era for them. And it's not the best effort, and it shows, but definitely if you're a Universal completist, this is probably one for you as well.
Yeah, I'm really into that sort of late 80s, early 70s sort of subgenre of horror where, like, a lot of the Hammer guys were taking on really pulpy stuff that was almost sort of vaguely Lovecraft, vaguely, like, you know, Robert E. Howard stuff, like Creeping Flesh is one of them. Like, of course, the Island of Terror I haven't seen, but this sounds like it's very much in that realm. Horror Express, where it's really classy traditional horror actors taking on really weird and fairly lowbrow concepts.
That'll pretty much add. You just pretty much summed up, you know, the tone of this film.
Yeah, I'm really into the, and you know, Terence Fisher, I think his best film was actually. Weirdly going to come a couple of years after this, The Devil Rides Out, or I think in America it's usually known as The Devil's Bride, maybe?
Yeah, I think TCM played it as The Devil Rides Out.
Yeah, I think by now that's they've sort of gotten to that in America. I think the issue back in the late 60s was they were, with the Rides Out language, they were worried people might mistake it for a Western. But we don't really have Westerns anymore, so...
Yeah. And one more from Shout, or Scream, this coming week. A collector's edition Blu-ray of 1992's The Lawnmower Man with Pierce Brosnan, Jeff Fahey. Both the theatrical and director's cuts of this film are available on this set. And so if you're a fan of early 90s... sci-fi horror, I guess is the best way to put this film. The Lawnmower Man, kind of a well-known film. I've seen it before. The first time I saw it, I remember I was watching it on cable, and I was like, this movie is so long. I don't think that bodes well. The Lawnmower Man is definitely a movie that I remember. It had a lot of, at the time, state-of-the-art visual effects in there, computer-generated effects. So definitely an interesting release this week from Scream.
It's also a really sort of interesting moment in just general pop culture when everyone was sort of cluing into what the internet was, what computers were doing at the time, and the big buzzword was virtual reality. Like, everyone thought the future was VR. Even like your mom knew what virtual reality was.
That's right.
Didn't really pan out.
No, it didn't. You know, by the time, 1995, was it Virtuosity? Yeah, by the time that movie came out, it was already old news, you know?
Denzel and Russell Crowe just killed virtual reality dead. And let us not forget Johnny Mnemonic, which I guess is more more of a classic cyberpunk story. But yeah, we were really entranced with these ideas in the mid-90s, and it sort of led to The Matrix, except The Matrix is just sort of using those as a platform for big action sequences. I think they kind of forgot that with the sequels.
Yeah. Speaking of sequels, you know, The Lawnmower Man had a sequel as well called Job's War. It actually had a couple of titles. It was Lawnmower Man 2, Job's War, and there was also it also went under the title Beyond Cyberspace. I think I've got a copy of The Lawnmower Man 2 for some reason, but I don't have The Lawnmower Man 1. So I'm going to have to rectify that, I guess.
Yeah, and, you know, I saw Lawnmower Man 2 way back when it first came out. I don't remember much of it. Now I'm kind of tempted to rewatch it because playing Job in this one is Matt Frewer.
Max Headroom himself.
Yeah, so that's an interesting bit of casting. He's pretty much always going to be watchable.
Yeah, he is. We'll get back to y'all on that. The Matt Frewer as Job. We'll report back to our listeners how that worked out. Yep.
Oh, and one more Scream Factory release this week is a Paul Naschy collection.
Oh yeah, that's right.
This is five movies on Blu-ray. Pretty surprised. Amazon's got it at just over $45, which for, you know, five movies, it seems like a good mix of his stuff. We've got Vengeance of the Zombies, Horror Rises from the Tomb, Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll, Night of the Werewolf, and Human East. So it's not just a collection of his werewolf-oriented stuff. It seems like a really good intro into Paul Naschy.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, everyone's got to start somewhere. If you're interested in digging deep, you know, into genre films, when a collection like this comes out, probably be your best start is to, you know, dig through these collections that come out and, find some stuff that you like. And I think with Paul Naschy, now, I'm not familiar with his work, but I'm assuming that this collection probably highlights, you know, what would be considered some of his better stuff.
Yeah, it's a really good mix of tones. I mean, Blue Eyes of the Broken Doll is like him doing a giallo film. Horror Rises from the Tomb is basically like Black Sunday. He's playing a warlock, and he's playing like a modern-day descendant of the warlock who's the one who resurrects him. It's just a good mix of weird stuff. Basically, a Paul Naschy film. The whole thing is take another horror film or horror like concept, make it cheaper and bloodier and with more nudity, and with effects that are both completely unrealistic and weirdly grotesque for being completely unrealistic.
Yeah, sounds pretty awesome.
It's definitely like he's a great like Sunday afternoon movie choice. Anything of his, pretty much.
So there you go. Your new releases from both last week and this week. So catch up, just like we've had to. So I guess we talked a bit about the 90s. I remember talking about The Lawnmower Man, and I think that's a good segue into our main topic this week, which basically is horror films of the 90s, which The Lawnmower Man would be considered part of. In the 80s, the height of the video era, you know, when movie distributors, movie companies started catering to, the video stores with these direct-to-video releases. And you had a lot of films in the 80s, throughout the 80s, just develop cult followings. And there's a ton of movies from the 80s, dozens, maybe even hundreds of movies from the 80s that people fondly remember. But, you know, when we move into the 90s, you kind of don't see that as much. Maybe with good reason, considering, some of the titles that were released in the 90s, which we'll get into some of them here. But let me ask you first, Joel, what do you think is the reason behind the decrease in, I guess we'll say, interest, for lack of a better term, in horror films in the early part of the 90s.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of intersecting reasons here. I think part of it is that you have one particular style of horror that was really omnipresent, and they just oversaturated the market with slasher films. So I think that's a huge reason. I think, you know, you've still got video stores really successful, but I think when the 90s hit, you're starting to hit just past the peak where a lot of the local video stores are sort of starting to sell off, and the chain stores like Blockbuster are taking over. So you've got stores that are mostly focused on sort of a formula of lots of copies of new releases. I mean, the local video store is great for horror films because they'll buy like anything cheap and just to stock their shelves. Blockbuster didn't need to do that. And, you know, a Blockbuster, Hollywood Video, whatever chain, was more family-oriented anyway. They stocked a lot of big blockbusters and family films. You know, it's really the local video store that was the haven of the, you know, disreputable, you know, the horror films and the pornographic films. So you had like, those coming together. A lot of horror films were starting to do less business. Even the franchise films were starting to do less business in theaters. So a lot of the sequels, especially of lesser franchises, were coming out straight to video, which also meant that the straight to video stuff was getting more crowded, because if you've got your choice of bad new horror films coming out and it's between, you know, some random Prom Night sequel or some random slasher film you've never heard of, you're probably going to go with the Prom Night sequel because you know what a Prom Night is.
Right, yeah. You know, you know some of these franchises you're talking about, of course, Friday the 13th, A Nightmare on Elm Street, Halloween, well, especially in terms of Friday the 13th and Nightmare on Elm Street, those franchises were winding down, especially in the early part of the decade. Those tended to make more money in rentals, I think, than on the big screen. And then there's a couple of franchises that actually endured through the 90s, such as the Child's Play franchise, and Halloween, of course, continued to endure through the 90s.
Yeah, it was a weird moment, because Friday the 13th was under new management. New Line had just bought it from Paramount to make the Freddy versus Jason crossover. But of course, as we know, that wouldn't end up coming out till 2003, was it? Yeah, 2003. And that wasn't for lack of trying, because there were a lot of unused scripts for Freddy versus Jason. I've read them all, and they're almost all terrible. And it's interesting looking at them, because none of them feel like a Friday the 13th or Nightmare on Elm film. And I think one of the other issues at play here is that Silence of the Lambs, I think, is kind of the, you know, when people say Nirvana's Nevermind killed grunge music and grunge music killed hair metal, Silence of the Lambs kind of killed the slasher film. Because now there's this respectable film with like name actors and respectable director winning Oscars, and then every horror film, and of course it was a gigantic hit, so every horror filmmaker wanted to do their own Silence of the Lambs. So like instead of teenage heroes who were just basically barely holding on through a situation they could barely comprehend, you had a lot of cop heroes, you had a lot of doctors, psychologists. I mean, you know, Freddy's dead. You know, you think you're gonna get like the main kid, who you don't know the name of, they just call him John Doe in the film, who is heavily implied to be this Jacob, the son of Alice in Nightmare 5, the Dream Child. You think he's gonna be the hero, but he's just kind of a decoy protagonist. And your main hero is Catherine, Lisa Zane, who is a psychologist or psychiatrist helping at-risk youth, things like that. I mean, a number of the unused Freddy Jason scripts, you know, had those kind of professional, you know, psychologist and cop characters as your main characters instead of teenagers. Even, you know, even Jason Goes to Hell, like, you know, they included, they actually went back and filmed that scene where the teenagers who were having sex in the tent die, because the test audiences were asking why there were no teenagers having sex.
Yeah, that's a good story for that one. I think the whole procedural aspect in, you know, to take the Silence of the Lambs, for example, the whole procedure of, you know, investigating into the killings, it actually, you know, developed a good, it developed a good, respectable story, you know, to complement the actual, you know, scenes with killings. And just seeing the main characters at work trying to figure out who done it, you just added that element that just wasn't there in these other movies. And I think it's not inaccurate to say that Silence of the Lambs killed, you know, the slasher flick, because it just took the basics and it added an air of, I guess, professionalism to them.
Yeah, you know, I think one of the things is that horror films inevitably become action films as they go on, because if the same protagonists are around, because the more you know about what you're up against, the less frightening it is. So a lot of horror franchises turn vaguely action-oriented or fantasy-oriented, has, you know, protagonists recurred as characters. I mean, Phantasm sort of did that, but Phantasm is so weird it can still be kind of a horror film. You know, the Alien films kept trying to go back to horror, like in Alien 3, but if it's still Ripley, you're not going to be able to do that, because no one knows more about these things than Ripley. So I think one of the big sort of jokes from cynical audience members or critics is the, you know, the slasher film teenager who walks into an abandoned cabin with lights out, there's cats jumping out, and is saying, Billy, are you there? Like, that stereotype of, like, slasher films became so ingrained that it seems like almost the natural logical reaction was going to be protagonists defined by their knowledge and the ability to acquire more knowledge. I mean, even something like Candyman, you know, you've got a main character who's a grad student and a professor studying these local legends and actively learning about what's going on. I mean, you've almost got sort of a Lovecraftian thing where you've got characters gathering forbidden knowledge in some of these films. So, yeah, one of the interesting late slasher film takes. I'm not sure. Have you seen Dr. Giggles?
I saw Dr. Giggles once a long time ago, Joel. It has been some time since I've seen it. In fact, Dr. Giggles was on my mind when we came up with the topic.
It is kind of a definitive 90s horror film.
It is. And I have one that I want to throw alongside it once you're finished what you want to say there.
Of course, Dr. Giggles, I mean, of course, continuing the doctor thing, except in this case the doctor is the villain. And it still follows a lot of the slasher film tropes, but you know, an ongoing subplot is a young police officer who's actively usually the police are pretty obstructionist or just incompetent in most of these, who's a young, fairly competent and idealistic and noble cop who's helping out and learning the history of this killer. And, you know, Dr. Giggles is a weird film because it's trying to be many things. It's trying to be like a goofy horror comedy in the later Nightmare on Elm Street vein, where you've got a jokey killer. It's trying to be like kind of satirical. It's trying to be a serious psychological horror film talking about this guy's upbringing. And, you know, the only reason it succeeds at any of this is because Larry Drake as Dr. Giggles, I mean, is so good at everything.
Yeah, Larry Drake, you know, especially after, you know, I remember first seeing him, of course, L.A. Law as Benny, I guess he was he's a good actor. He's very underrated. And then he was in Darkman as the villain Durant. And so, yeah, I approve of anything that Larry Drake is in.
He's fantastic in everything. I've seen him in Dark Knight of the Scarecrow. There's a Tales from the Crypt episode he's on, and we'll get to Tales from the Crypt later because I think one of the things that we're going to end up talking about is how much horror was on television this time.
Yeah.
You know, he just gives such great lines, and so much of the dialogue is bad, but he delivers it, finds such strange, interesting ways to deliver it that it seemed like it mitigates it. It makes it more interesting than it would be. And Dr. Giggles, I love bringing up in 90s horror because the teenagers are so, first of all, in most cases, so old for teenagers. Like, I mean, that's not surprising. I mean, I'm part of the reason I'm sure these slasher films started to disappear is because you lost a lot of these smaller regional companies that were making like very cheap horror films outside, like I'm sure outside set like Screen Actors Guild purview most of the time, outside most like working laws. And you know, one of the reasons we usually get such old people, like ancient 20-year-olds playing teenagers, is because children have working hour regulations. I mean, you can't just keep a kid on set for like a 16-hour day. But Dr. Giggles would be worth watching just for how hilariously tenured the teenage dialogue is, and how these teenagers are nothing like teenagers ever.
Well, see, Dr. Giggles is. I'll have to go back and rewatch it to get to form, you know, an accurate opinion of it. But it just reminds me of some of these probably like some creativity issues that filmmakers were going through in this part of the 90s. That includes Dr. Giggles, but I wanted to throw in you know, something like I guess The Dentist with Corbin Burnson, and also Clint Howard as Ice Cream Man.
It was very much like pro wrestling in the 90s for all of our Place to Be Nation friends, where you couldn't just be a killer, you couldn't just be a pro wrestler, you had to have like a secondary occupation. And part of it, I think, is that like that horror comedy trend where like everyone wanted, like, for some reason, the next Nightmare on Elm Street, the next Leprechaun. So you had to have like Clint Howard as Ice Cream Man, Toby Radloff as Killer Nerd. You know, Uncle Sam, you had so many like high concept slasher films. Jack Frost.
Yeah, Jack Frost is another good one. But you mentioned Leprechaun movies. Now you want to take Leprechaun and its 90s run alongside the Child's Play run with Chucky, and suddenly these movies, the Leprechaun and the Chucky series, become less about horror. I mean, there's still some horrific killings in those movies, but you know, the idea of a doll and a leprechaun being murderous, it's just, your immediate reaction is to laugh. And so that was I think that was an issue in the 90s, is marketing these movies. Is it a comedy? Is it a horror? You know, what do you want to see? Do you want to see Leprechaun? Oh man, that movie sounds ridiculous. I don't want to see that. You know, so I mean, that I think that goes back into, you know, one of the creative issues in the decade, along with killers and their, you know, professions, like being a dentist or a doctor or an ice cream man. You've also got a killer doll and a killer leprechaun. And yeah, I think they were showing signs of really like running out of ideas.
And I think part of it is they had stretched so many formulas so thin that they really didn't know like how to scare an audience anymore. You know,
I think they tried to equate killing people with scaring people. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And things like atmosphere and mood and tension and all that went by the wayside.
I think it's forgotten how much, like, the early Nightmare on Elm Streets and the early Friday the 13th even were built on atmosphere. Of course, Halloween, of course, being Carpenter. But, like, yeah, and it's also a familiarity breeds contempt thing. The more you see something, the less you're afraid of it, especially when it's a killer doll. And, I mean, yeah, it feels weird for me to be saying now because I was young in the early 90s. So when a trailer for a Child's Play sequel came on, I was out of the room. Like that's I was still young enough to be affected by that stuff. But, you know, Child's Play, they turned into sort of an interesting black comedy series with Bride of Chucky and Seed of Chucky. Like they consciously went for not just horror comedy, but a very sort of satire comedy. I mean, to the point where John Waters shows up in Seed of Chucky. But Leprechaun just went for, like, gimmick after gimmick. I mean, Leprechaun 3 is in Vegas. 4 was in space, which also was...
Leprechaun in the hood, yeah.
Which was so successful, he went back to the hood. Which is sort of the ultimate, like, nadir of, like, how many gimmicks can we squeeze out of the series? And, you know, to the credit of the Leprechaun sequels, I mean, 3 and 4 were directed by Brian Trenchard-Smith, who's pretty reliably, like, entertaining no matter what he does. And those films were so strange and so loopy that, like, it's hard to dislike them because clearly they know what they're working with and they're just trying to be entertaining and weird and grotesque.
Yeah, I have trouble believing that the same guy that did Turkey Shoot is the same guy that did, you know, some of the Leprechaun movies.
Oh my God! Yeah, and hey, you do what you can, and at the very least, like, so Brian Trenchard-Smith brought so much to those films that would have been. I'm not saying they were good films, but they were entertaining little like. Goofy movies, and I feel with a lesser director they wouldn't have even been watchable.
Yeah, but not scary though, dude. That's the thing. I mean, they're considered horror films. I mean, that's where if you were to go into a video store back in the day and check out the horror section, that's where you're going to find Leprechaun. But you can't really say that they were scary, and that was part of the issue, you know.
No, I think you're almost at that point getting into like. What you'd almost call a popcorn horror realm. I mean, not that horror in general isn't, but like sort of like the kind of stuff that the self-conscious grindhouse tropes that like Rodriguez and Tarantino do with like From Dusk Till Dawn and Planet Terror and Death Proof, like. That stuff was happening even before them because you had a lot of stuff. You had stuff like Tales from the Crypt, Demon Night, or Brian Trenchard-Smith's Night of the Demons 2. They were basically action, like chaotic action comedy horrors, like big mash genre horror.
Yeah.
But those in particular, especially Night of the Demons 2 and Demon Night, worked because they have so much energy and even though it's not necessarily that they're scary, but they are tense because they're using that sort of Night of the Living Dead, A Solemn Precinct 13, we're locked in a house and everything outside is trying to kill us, like, structure, which is, you know, that sort of fortress siege structure that is really hard to screw up.
Yeah, I agree with that, with the point there, Joel. You know, there are some one-off... You know, films from the decade that kind of make their mark, burn themselves in your brain a little bit. We're talking more along the lines of the psychological, I think. You got a movie like Jacob's Ladder with Tim Robbins, In the Mouth of Madness with Sam Neill, directed by John Carpenter. These tended to be, I think. In my view, a little bit more successful than, you know, stuff like Child's Play, Leprechaun, mainly because they hit you in a different part of your brain.
Oh, I think so. I mean, you know, at its best, the sort of post Silence of the Lambs horror, like getting hit, like whether it's like a very psychological oriented mines through horror, like Jacob's Ladder, whether it's, I'm not a particular fan of Seven, but I mean, it's hard to really deny the influence of that film. You've got that sort of Lovecraftian horror. As I bring up Lovecraft all the time, but In the Mouth of Madness is pure Lovecraft. And it's actually surprising that more horror directors didn't go that way because, and maybe in a certain way they did, because one of the other big subgenres of horror I want to get to in a little bit is what you might call the metafiction horror, which Lovecraft was always big on, even before we had a term coined like metafiction, like incorporating fragments of fictional books that you're trying to convince people are real books out there in the world, just extremely rare, or doing your story in the style of a nonfiction piece, like an expedition piece that they're familiar with. Like, 90s horror started, like, I think once they hit the limit of what they could do with, like, a slasher film, like, they started getting in that sort of Lovecraftian there's no fourth wall moment, which is where you get things like Wes Craven's New Nightmare.
New Nightmare. The epitome of meta horror. Here you've got Heather Langenkamp and Robert Englund basically playing themselves shooting the movie Nightmare on Elm Street. I think it was quite an interesting take, I think, on the horror genre, though.
Oh, definitely. I think it was actually pretty ahead of its time, because I don't think it didn't seem very successful, although it was really it was really well regarded critically, even by mainstream critical outlets. Just a really phenomenal idea using, like, taking a character that everyone knew that people were sick of, and making him scary again. Cutting loose the fourth wall, providing like really, really circuitous sort of strange take on the material. It just made it surprising again, and surprise is a big element in what makes these things work.
Yeah, I think it actually breathed some life back into the Freddy Krueger character after, I think, in the last maybe, I want to say at least the last two films of the series, he was treated more like parody of what he was originally supposed to be.
Yeah, I think, the dividing line is Dream Warriors and Dream Master. Like, I think they hit that balance of funny and scary perfectly in Dream Warriors and Dream Master. They sort of went over it. And, that was the peak of the franchise financially until Freddy vs. Jason. So, I think one of the reasons they decided to kill him off nominally is that Dream Child did much worse than Four, which was the best performer in the series at that point.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm looking through a list of movies from the 90s there. I also see a noted trend of taking original stories or novels and turning to films like Bram Stoker's Dracula, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, and then of course you've got the Anne Rice Vampire Chronicles with the Interview with the Vampire with Tom Cruise, and I don't want to really include Anne Rice into these traditional stories, but the trend was there, taking a well-known piece of work and turning it into a horror film. It got trendy there in the mid-90s for that.
Yeah, it was a weird moment where, and you had a lot of classic monsters again, which, and fairly reconstructionist takes on them. I mean, even guys like who was it that did Bram Stoker's Dracula? Was that Coppola?
Coppola.
Yeah. Yeah, you had even like very well-regarded, renowned filmmakers taking on this stuff and doing a sort of almost throwback kind of approach to it, with classic creepy elements and very, you know, very attentive to the actual text of the original novels. And maybe that's just because it was something that hadn't been seen before, really. I mean, the Universal Frankenstein and Dracula were their own templates, and they weren't necessarily as close to the original novels, and they became the template. Maybe it was just because people weren't familiar anymore with the original novels. People were interested in doing that again. I would almost put Interview with the Vampire in more of the trend coming down from the lesbian vampire films of the 70s, like Vampire Lovers, to Fright Night and the Lost Boys, which have their have marked gay subtext to it. It's almost in that sort of monster queer element of horror. Like, it's more playing to that crowd, that heavy like LGBTQ crowd that's pronounced in the horror fandom. Like, and of course Anne Rice has her own huge fandom anyway, and it sort of fits into that whole goth scene that was big in the early 90s. This has a subset of grunge. I mean, if you like that sort of like industrial music and their fetish gear crowd, like you even see that like approached in some of the films. Like, obviously, like, you know, there's elements of that in terms of Clive Barker films, and like even like some of the Hellraiser sequels, like Hellraiser 3 especially, were
right,
set among those kinds of people.
Yeah, another good point there. And that's something I didn't really pick up on. I mean, Interview with the Vampire, obviously, yes, but the Hellraiser series you referred to there, I didn't really pick up on, but that's a good point, something I'll probably have to go back and rewatch for.
They're trying to find an audience, and I think the audience, just in general at this point, not as much as it is now, is just becoming increasingly fragmented. So you're seeing a lot of horror filmmakers really break off and try to appeal to specific crowds. I mean, you know, you've got like the Anne Rice crowd and the Clive Barker films trying to appeal to that and to what, yeah, I'm just generically calling a goth subculture. You've got sort of a spate of urban horror films that like are never unfortunately really caught on as a trend, and actually might finally do that now with the success of Get Out, but like, you know, mostly taken on by white filmmakers. I mean, you've got stuff like People Under the Stairs, you've got Candyman, you've got Tales from the Hood, which, you know, films that are, you know, very openly about race relations that are set in typically urban areas or, you know, sort of, you've got the Candyman sequels, I think, were in New Orleans. But they're set in, like, the ghetto, basically, talking with black characters, talking about class, talking about racism. And some of them, like Tales from Hood, much more openly satirical than others. But, you know, that aside from like a few niche things that never really caught on, and I don't know if it died because Snoop Dogg decided to star in one.
Did he ruin it for everybody?
Did Snoop ruin it for everyone? And it might just be a case where Hollywood only really has room for like two films for a black audience a year, and one's inevitably going to be like a family comedy or a romantic comedy, and one, God,
the other one's good. The other one's going to be a Tyler Perry film.
Yeah, it's going to be. I guess in the mid '90s, like pre Tyler Perry, it was Eddie Murphy, maybe.
Yeah, I think so. I think I mean, that was he had a lot of misses in the early part of the decade. I think that where he tried to veer away from his typical action comedy buddy cop movie, and so I remember movies like Boomerang and gosh, I can't remember. Of course, he tried to come back with Vampire in Brooklyn, and we know how successful that was.
Yeah, I find it interesting. Like, there seemed to be like a lot of very half-assed takes on classic horror monsters, even by otherwise consistent filmmakers. I mean, Vampire in Brooklyn was Craven, right?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, mid-90s, you have sort of a weird mini trend of werewolf films coming back, and they're all like werewolf films about male, like about impotence or about like male virility. I mean, you've got American Werewolf in Paris, you've got Wolf with Jack Nicholson.
Yes.
Was it Bad Moon from 96?
Bad Moon. Is that Aidan Quinn?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. That was on Shout Factory TV a few nights ago. They were streaming one horror film a night, and Bad Moon, I think, was on night two. And I failed to catch it, so it's yet again eluded my grasp.
Yeah, I haven't seen it either. That sort of, you know, self-consciously mature take on, like, classic monsters, that became kind of a mini-trend. You know, what you've got here is a lot of filmmakers grasping at straws, and what's interesting is that most of these are being done by fairly veteran filmmakers. I mean, I think one of the reasons this horror took a downturn is that it's often sort of a cheap way for younger filmmakers to ply their trade and really get used to making full-length films. Like, you get stuff like in the 80s, like that whole Empire Pictures crew, like, say, take The Dungeon Master, where all seems to be like a loosely tied together collection of shorts by like a half dozen or so different directors all getting a chance behind the camera.
Right, yes.
So you didn't get as much of that. Even, like, of course, one of the only bulwarks of, like, horror in the mid-90s is successor to Empire Pictures, which was a lot of Empire directors and a lot of veteran guys like Jeff Burr, like, doing these films, continuing on with these films. Full Moon's a weird case because I feel like their success is less that the video market was thriving and more that Full Moon was really good at marketing themselves to video stores.
Yeah, I can see that. I mean, you got a lot of these movies that probably aren't marketable on a wide distribution level. I mean, the Puppet Master series, just that's going to have a niche audience, and you can't see that making millions of dollars at the box office. So, I mean, why not sell it to video stores and make millions on rentals?
Full Moon was almost like early Marvel Comics in like coming up with great gimmicks to get people in it, like into what Full Moon Studios itself was doing. I mean, they had tons of promo items for video stores, like trading cards, shirts, and stuff. They had on their VHSs, they had Full Moon's Video Zone, I think it was, like these.
Oh yeah, the little featurettes at the end or the beginning of their tapes.
Yeah, usually about 20 minutes to 30 minutes, and you'd have a making of that particular film and like some trailers for upcoming Full Moon stuff, and just like some discussions from Charles Band and other like Full Moon creators, like what was in the works. It was very much like, you know, that jocular Stanley letters page in the early Marvel comics, like,
yeah,
you know, it was sort of a brand loyalty thing, which I don't think had ever really been done in horror films before.
Yeah, and for those who aren't familiar, of course, with Full Moon, I mean, you've not just the Puppet Master series, but they also had the Subspecies series, and which was, I guess we'll classify that as a vampire series, as well as, I guess a companion piece to Puppet Master would be Demonic Toys. And I remember there was a Tim Thomerson played a doll man, and there's a doll man Demonic Toys crossover.
Which also crossed over with one of their weird one-off films, Bad Channels. The female lead in Doll Man Demonic Toys and Doll Man's love interest was one of the girls in Bad Channels who got turned into a miniature woman by aliens. Because this is the genius we're dealing with here.
Exactly. Definitely Full Moon is still a strong favorite, because now they've got a streaming service that they attract a niche audience as well, and but they've got so many franchises that they've got their own streaming service for all of them.
Yeah, Full Moon is a really interesting singular case because, I mean, of course a lot of filmmakers sort of hit on that, the idea of coming up with these big, like, pitchable concepts that you could make on the cheap and just keep making. Like, I mean, Full Moon sort of went way too far with it. I mean, Puppet Master was good, but, like, they got into self-parody by the time they got to Ginger Dead Man and Evil Bong.
Ginger Dead Man, Evil Bong, Killjoy.
Oh, God, Killjoy. Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, even Demonic Toys had a level of self-parody to it. I think so much of this is just them trying to recreate Puppet Master, which, yeah, you know, there was... I think what they've forgotten is that the design of the puppets themselves was so... Especially for a kid in the 90s, like... Puppet Master films were uniquely popular with kids at my school. I think that's just because they were on the Sci-Fi Channel all the time. Like, to the point where I dressed as Blade for Halloween one year with other friends of mine who were other puppets.
That's actually pretty awesome.
Yeah, no, they were just... I think Puppet Master is kind of a unique thing in that they're a gory horror film that you could probably convince your parents to get you because the puppets look cool and they're kind of cute.
Yeah, and just on a side, I was a fan of the first Demonic Toys film. I remember reviewing the film in the early stages of my website when I was known as B-Movie Memories, and I gave Demonic Toys a 4-star rating out of 5. I was just enthralled with it. I think mostly because, you know, the dolls cuss in the movie.
Yeah. And that's, I think if they learned anything from their movies, that seems to be what they took from it. Like, their current franchises are much more Demonic Toys than they are Puppet Master.
Yeah, I think that's an accurate assessment of that, Joel.
Yeah, I mean, Full Moon was a weird case where, of course they did stuff was like, you know, trying to tap into the zeitgeist. I mean, Arcade 93, which was very like, let's do a cheapo lawnmower man.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
Yeah, and which it was actually a pretty successful little film, and that's one that I'm surprised they never got a sequel out of because that seemed like a really well-regarded one by just your average, like, B-movie film goer. But, yeah, Full Moon basically managed to carve out a niche for themselves really well to the point where, like, you know, they came out with action figures in the late 90s, direct market action figure boom was happening. It's a singular thing. It's like almost stands separate from the rest of what we're talking about because no one else managed to pull that off.
Yeah, and so, yeah, they're still going strong today, probably because they built their fan base in the 90s, and they've stuck with them, and, you know, they've, you know, gained some new fans along the way just from, you know, staying the course and staying true to what they are, just, you know, cheap, quickly made horror/comedy films that are just silly, over-the-top madness.
Yeah, and so, you know, it's funny that so many people did the silly over-the-top horror comedies in the mid-90s, and no one else franchised it quite like Full Moon, and there are better horror comedies out there, I mean, than most of their, I mean, like, you know, 1990 Frankenhooker is probably better than, I'm sure, most Full Moon films. I mean, you could put up something like, that sort of doesn't fit in with the whole Full Moon thing, like Stuart Gordon's Castle Freak.
Right.
But, like, you could put that up against Frankenhooker, but, like, you know, that's just an excellent, smart horror comedy. You know, of course, there's Dead Alive and Army of Darkness, which we haven't really discussed. And there's Army of Darkness sort of goes with, and to an extent, Dead Alive sort of goes with what I was talking about, that sort of popcorn horror genre with, like, Night of the Demons 2 and Demon Knight. Like, just, they're action films with horror elements more than anything.
Yeah, I wanted to get a mention on Dead Alive, because I really think in terms of gore, Dead Alive is probably the one horror film from the decade that stands out more than the others. I mean, if you want to, if someone says to you, "Hey, Joel, can you recommend me like a 90s film that's just full of gore?" And one of the first ones that should be mentioned should be Dead Alive.
Oh, easily. And, yeah, that brings to mind, like, Dead Alive stands against a couple of the points we're making, because it wasn't a veteran filmmaker. Peter Jackson was fairly early in his career.
Yeah.
And it's not an American film. We're mostly talking about horror films in American. They weren't incredibly successful in Europe either, and in the at the end of the decade, they're going to start getting, or at least in the latter half of the decade, they're going to start getting really important and popular in Japan and South Korea. But those things won't have an effect on American horror for a few years after that.
Right.
So like the stuff we're talking about, I mean, like Dead Alive. It probably took a few years to have an effect, and same with Army of Darkness, which was kind of a bomb. I mean, those I think ended up having an outsized effect on American horror. It just took a while, and I think this is an era where the MPAA was still kind of rough on horror, but not as much as they were in the late 80s, where like someone would stub a toe in a Friday the 13th film and they'd give it an NC-17.
Yeah. I think the NC-17 rating was used more in the 90s than it's been any other time. I mean, it's still a rating. They still actually have that rating in existence, right?
Yeah, it's just
that
economic
death. Yeah, if you're labeled with an NC-17 rating, then no one's going to see you. No theater is going to carry you. Whatever the case is. But, I think it was used more in the 90s than at any other time.
Yeah, that was before they really got into the realm of, let's release, like, an edited version in theater and then, like, the uncut version, which was basically an R for the home release, which started in the 2000s. Dead Alive is sort of singular because, now... like blood effects, they're fine. Like, I mean, we see worse on The Walking Dead, like on basic cable, than we saw on Dawn of the Dead in 1978.
Yeah,
like,
exactly.
Probably not worse, just like more gratuitous, because like Thomas Savini gore effects have a veracity to them that like gore effects typically don't. Especially with the zombie trend that has been going on for like a decade now with no sign of stopping, God help us. Like, people are just okay with gore now. I don't know if it's just a generation of parents who grew up watching Friday the 13th and they've just seen it all by this point.
Yeah, there's a little bit of desensitization. There we go. Going on here in terms of, gore. I mean, it's becoming more and more acceptable. My generation, I'll say Generation X, we really, the video era was for us, and Friday the 13th and Halloween, and we grew up on that stuff, and it's just open the door to allow more extreme graphic scenes to be embedded in our brains, and I think it's just become acceptable now. And I know that there's young people out there now that when they go to a horror movie, they want to see gore, and gore doesn't necessarily make a film great. Course, but there's always been that group of fans that equate gore with awesomeness.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been gore hounds, and even within that there's a bit of variation, because some like Dead Alive or Evil Dead, slapsticky gore, like Refuge and Audacity kind of stuff, and some people are really into like torture porn. I mean, even beyond like Saw, I mean, some people are into like August Underground. They're into you know, the Campbell films. They want, they're sort of playing a game of chicken with themselves.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, so there is that element. You know, horror films, I mean, if you loosely talked about, like, how horror films, like, shift in the mainstream, it's usually between gore and between atmosphere. Like, so, like, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, you had a spate of ghost films. You had, of course, you had, like, Sixth Sense. You had a lot of, you had the found footage stuff, starting with, like, Blair Witch Project.
Right.
You had remakes of Haunting and House of Haunted Hill. You had, like, a lot of, you know, ghost, even some possession stuff, Stigmata, Stir of Echoes, which I guess was a ghost film. But, like, you know, you had a lot of, like, mature adult ghost films, What Lies Beneath, stuff for, like, middle-aged audiences. And then you, at the same time, has sort of, a counterbalance to, like, the self-aware teen slasher films at the time. And then the adult stuff kicks into, like, procedural torture porn mashups like Saw, and then the kids are watching Paranormal Activity.
Right. Yeah, so, I mean, I don't necessarily think, you know, you're talking about gorehounds, and I don't know if there's any crossover appeal to, you know, a found footage horror film with that group. Dude, gorehounds are probably just out looking for gore. But, you know, something like Paranormal Activity or Blair Witch Project, the found footage genre just lends itself more to, I guess it's kind of like, people who crane their necks at a car wreck, you know, it feels real, you know, you get the way it's shot, and they want to see what happens, you know?
Yeah, there's sort of that weird urgency, that weird, frisson, I think is the word, like, just that, is it that question lingering, is it real? I mean, you know, Blair Witch Project is a marginal film, but, like, they, you know, the marketing campaign made the film by convincing people this is actually real. This is,
right.
This is before, you know, before audiences were used to that gag, were too cynical. And a film that doesn't get brought up enough in this genre, that's a British film from 92. It's, I almost hesitate to call it a film, Ghost Watch.
Okay, yeah.
Which is absolutely brilliant exercise. It's a news program that played on Halloween that advertised itself as a real news program and a look into a haunted, possessed house. And starring actual newscasters that British audiences were familiar with, and becomes a horror film over the course of it. And, like, to the point that, you know, by the end, when everything is going to hell, like in a great ghost or possession film, like, it starts affecting the actual studio that the main newscasters are in.
Right.
Like, so I guess the spiritual, like, predecessor of that would be the Orson Welles War of the Worlds broadcast, like, using a form people innately trusted and telling them a story without them realizing they're getting a story.
Yeah. And, yeah, the just genuine reactions, I guess, is what they're looking for from an audience.
Yeah, and, you know, Ghostwatch apparently was very controversial in Britain. Like, the network got tons of angry calls and letters, like, you know, because it just scared the hell out of people, because they weren't expecting it. They were expecting, like, a spooky, like, you know, infotainment show, and they got, like, a horror film that was damn effective anyway.
Yeah.
Like, even watching it, knowing the gag, like, it's still a good, like, you know, a pseudo-documentary horror film.
Right. And I think there's a good stopping point there for a break there, Joel. What do you think? We've still got some ground to cover, and when
we still have the elephant in the room, the WB elephant in the room.
Yeah, we do. So what we'll do is we'll step away for a moment, take a break. When we come back, we'll get into kind of like a Day of the Animals theme with some of these movies, and the resurgence of the slasher flick, the teen slasher flick, in the mid to late 90s. So let's step away for a moment, pay some bills with some promos, and we will and we'll be back in just a moment.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rosero here, and I want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com, and we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current-day wrestling with Clotheslines and Headlines, Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows. And we leave wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse, the Our Vantage Point podcast, which features a potpourri-style look at wrestling history, and Survey Says, a fun look back at the good, bad, and ugly of WCW. And on our very popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler podcast, Our Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with hard-traveling fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversations, Geek and Sassy, and the Imaginary Stories. You can find all these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to both feeds on iTunes. And while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All these shows plus others available at PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlayStation.com/Amazon when doing your online shopping, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, thehistoryofwrestling.com, and Scott Keith's blog, of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlayStation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
The Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Subscribe on iTunes or on Android with your favorite podcast app. Established in 2013, the Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network is committed to providing unique takes on the rich and diverse medium of professional wrestling, focusing on its history and global impact, but also exploring the vibrant contemporary scene. The roll call includes Space City, an NWA On Demand podcast, This Week in Wrestling, Stacey and Elliott's Bogus Journey, the Super Apoitas podcast, The Military Industrial Suplex, Strong Style History, Puro Puri, and Psychology is Dead. Also, from the archives, the full catalog of great shows that provided a fresh look at classic wrestling, including Where the Big Boys Play, Titans of Wrestling, Tag Teams Back Again, Letters from Kayfabe, Wrestling Culture, Pro Wrestling Super Show, Goodwill Wrestling, and many, many others. Pro Wrestling Only Podcast Network. Only the best.
Welcome back. Thank you for sticking with us through the break. We're talking about horror in the 90s. The first half of the show is dedicated to talking about the decline of horror in the early part of the 90s and some of the standout films. Now we're going to get into a little bit resurgence here in the late 90s, here in just a bit. But one of the trends that you'll find in, especially in late 90s horror cinema, is kind of a Day of the Animal kind of trend. We've got various films such as Anaconda with John Voight, Jennifer Lopez, Ice Cube. And then we can get into, you've also, Lake Placid, which is, Yeah, it's currently got its run going on cable television quite frequently. Bridget Fonda, Bill Pullman, Oliver Platt. And then you got some not-so-conventional animals, Joel, in a film like Mimic.
Yeah, you know, the animal subgenre seems to cross over with sort of the monster subgenre. I think there's a couple reasons for this, but I think we got to give credit to the film that I think kept this stuff alive through the 90s, which is Tremors.
Tremors, yes.
Tremors, it was a surprising hit, and I'm actually surprised that ended up being a Universal film, because I would have thought killer animal films were dead for at least 10 years after Jaws the Revenge.
Yeah, Jaws the Revenge killed a lot of things, did it not?
I mean, I love Jaws the Revenge. As terrible as it is, I just have a deep abiding affection for all Jaws movies. But no, I mean, realistically, I think only Tremors even managed to keep the killer animal film alive by being a monster film. It was at least different enough from Jaws the Revenge where people could give it a chance, especially with a really cool idea, a really good hook. It's almost like a joke. Like someone took a look at Jaws and said, what's the opposite of Jaws? It's on the ground.
Right. It's underground. It's a sand shark. I'm sorry, that's probably been done by Sci-Fi already.
That actually has. That actually has, I'm pretty sure. Tremors kept monster movies going, and then I think, like, of course, you know, Critters was still going, but that's more in the, like, tiny monster genre. That's more of, like, a Puppet Master, Ghoulies kind of thing. Then, of course, in 1993, you get Jurassic Park, which, you know, gigantic film, which, you know, immediately spawns ripoffs. I mean, you know, Roger Corman comes through with Carnosaur. And sequels to that. You get, you know, various TV channels and cheap studios do remakes of, like, you know, the old, like, Lost World film, you know, the Silent Era one. Yeah. You know, I think at some point there had to have been a remake of The Land That Time Forgot around this time. You get monster films, you get like killer animal films, or even like films that have nothing to do with like that incorporate things like dinosaurs, like MST3K classic Future War.
Yes, sir.
We're also in an era. I mean, the 90s isn't the first era in which there's an environmental consciousness movement in America. I mean, you know, you could go back decades and decades. I mean, Roosevelt was a conservationist, Rachel Carson, Silver Spring. But you're at the point where you're in the era of recycling advertisements and Al Gore being vice president and Captain Planet. Like, there's increasing concern with post-industrial globalization, what's going on with the planet. First discussions really of climate change, or as it was being called then, global warming. All the monster films, killer animal films are always connected to environmental issues at the time. And I'd have to say so much of this comes from that. I mean, even Jurassic Park, I think, is inspired by that era of scientific thought. You get stuff like, you get like normal animals made bigger, like ticks in 93 or 94, mosquito in 95, which was actually, I guess, the first film review I ever wrote was about mosquito.
Oh, really? You had something good to cut your teeth on there.
In 1995, I was, I think, 9 years old.
Wow, man, you started early.
Writing reviews about mosquito.
All right.
So a lot of these are like normal animals made giant either through science or just remarkably just through nature. I mean, like anaconda is just, there's no scientific reason it's bigger than even normal anacondas. It's just bigger. Like sometimes you have science involved, like you have that in mosquito, you have that in, of course, Deep Blue Sea.
Yes.
And I forget if that was the case of like Blasted, but you've also got like monster films that are sort of indefinably alien monsters coming around. I mean, you've got The Relic, Deep Rising, which was that some weird tentacle monster? I forget.
Deep Rising. Gosh, I just saw part of that recently, and it's, you know, that's how awesome it was. It failed to stick with me.
You took your eyes off Treat Williams, and that was it. But no, I mean, I think it's a case where you could, it's another issue of filmmakers just throwing stuff at the wall. Like, well, normal killers aren't working for people. Procedurals, even by this point, I think were already burnt out because there were so many of them and you could get them on TV for free. Uh-huh. So, why not go with monsters and killer animals? And it seemed to work for a while. I mean, these films made money. Anaconda, Deep Blue Sea, they made money into Lake Placid.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was just sort of the era people think about our effect on the environment, or just, you know, they hadn't seen a killer animal film in a while. They were tired of talkative serial killers. They were tired of masked guys with chainsaws, and they just wanted something different.
Yeah, I think, you know, a lot of those tropes were really just, you know, like, oh, you know, masked killer, and I haven't seen this before. yeah, so there was really just, there's this lust there for something different, something new. And I think there was a whole lot of stuff thrown at the wall in the 90s and to see what would stick. And, you know, just there wasn't much along the lines of franchises, you know, being created in the 90s. I mean, you had stuff carried through the 90s, like we mentioned earlier, with Child's Play and Halloween and Leprechaun. But, you know, there wasn't really any major breakthrough in terms of hitting something that stuck to audiences.
No, I mean, most franchises, like, created in the 90s seem to become franchises just almost because what the hell else are you going to do? Like, which is why we got so many Leprechauns, which is why we got multiple Wishmasters.
Oh, yes, Wishmaster.
You know, even stuff that, like, I'm not sure how big it was, but I think did well enough, at least on video, like, say, The Prophecy.
Yeah, The Prophecy is a good one. Would you talk about the animal/monster movies? And I really think they found more of a home on, I guess, on cable television, you know, such as a channel like Sci-Fi, for instance. And yeah, I mean, it really became their, you know, their movie of the week. You know, on a Saturday or in the afternoon, you could tune in and find any number of killer shark movies or, you know, some kind of, you know, jungle creature, you know, hunting people down.
Yeah, it's become a running joke about the Sci-Fi channel. Sort of their, you know, channel's identity is killer animal films, especially shark movies, because shark films have become so mimetic, thanks to Sharknado and Sharktopus. And it's like now it's to the point where we're even seeing shark movies back in theater, which is insane because you can get on the Sci-Fi channel for free.
Right, yeah. You know, you're talking about you got that 47 meters down currently.
Yeah, before that, The Shallows and Shark Night 3D, which at least had the 3D gimmick to sell itself on.
So we can expect a shark movie once a year around summertime now.
I am so disappointed that, look, I don't want to see Jaws be remade, but you're telling me you're making an entire franchise, a misguided franchise of action horror Universal remakes, yeah, and you're not having Jaws fight the Mummy or the Creature from the Black Lagoon? No, we need Jaws.
Yeah, exactly. You know, and you know, unfortunately, they tried that with the Piranha remakes, and you know, see how that worked out.
Speaking of, there was a really weird moment, and this kind of ties into what we're going to talk about next. Showtime commissioned a pretty expansive series of Roger Corman remakes in the mid-90s, Piranha being one of them. I think, like, How to Make a Monster was one of them. I think they might have even gone into some other, like, 50s sci-fi. I'm pretty sure there was a remake of the Attack of the 50-Foot Woman around this time, but most of them were Corman ones. So I don't know if that was just to compete with HBO doing Tales from the Crypt or what the deal was.
Yeah, see, and I mean, Tales from the Crypt was just, you know, so big for HBO. I really think there was a revival in the anthology, the horror anthology series in the 90s, because you had like a Twilight Zone rebooting. There was The Outer Limits, and Tales from the Crypt pretty much influenced the horror anthology on television.
Yeah, and it starts a bit in the late 80s with the Twilight Zone reboot and Freddy's Nightmares, Tales from the Dark Side, Amazing Stories.
Yeah, the Friday the 13th series.
Oh, Friday the 13th series, yeah. And yeah, I think partly because it's just very practical. Like, a lot of directors, a lot of filmmakers and TV directors can get together and all get work out of it. So, and also, like, do something that's also not just TV work, which at the time was sort of a downturn for professionals. Not like it's really considered now, but like they could actually do something that was creatively satisfying. Because you get anthology films sort of die in the early 90s, which is interesting. I think like around 1990, you get like Two Evil Eyes. You get I'm not sure how many there were.
Tales from the Dark Side, the movie.
Yeah, the Willies, like, it just stops being made, but it starts to move to TV. With Tales from the Crypt, of course, being the big example, and partly, I don't know if it was just that the Crypt Keeper was such an awesome host that people were just innately drawn to it, because, I mean, John Cassier's voice acting is so perfect, the puppet is cool, and I think it's also, like, a different kind, like horror comedies films were like usually goofy, mostly in the action, they were on the action film side, or just like sort of like cartoonish, trying to be black comedy but too goofy to really be that. And Tales from the Crypt, by taking the story in the old EC comics, was just black comedy. It was you're gonna watch a terrible person get what's coming to him.
Yeah, and I think the anthology series is better played out, on television. I'm sorry, the anthology movie, just because it just has an episodic feel to it. I think it died, theatrically speaking, mainly because people want to see, when they go to the movies, they want to see one continuous story.
I think it's sort of exhausting almost seeing it in theater. Like at one of the Hudson Horror Shows, they played both Creepshow and Night Train to Terror on the same show, and they were really far apart. I mean, Creepshow was the final movie of the night, and Night Train was like the first or second movie of the day, and it was like just having two stories was almost exhausting. And I think the episode, that episodic feel, like, it just suits itself to television. I mean, Tales from the Crypt, you could just get like, like once a week, get in like a half hour, get like a mean, nasty story where a jerk gets what he deserves, and like that's it. You move on. I'm surprised they haven't made more of a comeback recently with the advent of like streaming television. I know Black Mirror is pretty popular to a certain like fan base, but I heard Inga Tales revival on TNT, which honestly would not surprise me.
Yeah, and I think we've mentioned that on here before, and that's something they need to be careful with, really, because something like that works late at night on a weekend. You know what I mean? It doesn't work at like 8 or 9 o'clock at night in the middle of the week. Something like that.
They're really taking a chance here, because right now audiences for years have been conditioned to ongoing sagas, like loads of characters, like stories, ongoing stories, characters coming together with like overarching plot lines and subplots. Like, I mean, movies and TV. I mean, the most popular TV shows are things like Walking Dead and Game of Thrones are the most popular for, TV network dramas. Yeah. It's kind of going against the kind of going against the grain to say we're going to do an anthology.
Yeah, it's kind of tricky. Like you said, you know, a lot of that stuff you mentioned is character-driven, and, you know, I guess people who invest their time in characters that they like and, you know, having an anthology series in front of them may not lend itself to that. So it's going to be interesting how that's going to play out.
Yeah, I'm curious. Does even, like, horror series now, like, I mean, I think of things like American Horror Story, or even Sci-Fi Channel is doing that Channel Zero thing where it's like every season is based on a different, like, online horror story or creepypasta. And it's like, which also seems like the wrong format for those, because that seems like that should be an anthology show. Like, I don't know how you can get a full season out of Candle Cove, but like doing anthology of film versions of different, like, creepypastas actually seems workable. But I don't know how well fated the TNT Tales from the Crypt is going to be. It's still up in the air, and who knows whether or not it's actually it couldn't even make it to TV.
Yeah, so we'll just wait and see how that plays out, as the saying goes. And I think, though, with the, you know, we talk about television, and we've had, you know, in the 90s, well, it's the CW now, but you had the WB network, and you had a lot of, you know, teen-centered dramatic programming in the 90s, and, you know, they developed a lot of future movie stars along the way, and it kind of sets it up for the resurgence of horror in the 90s, taking some of these young actors and putting them on the big screen in your teen slasher flick. And this is where we're going now. And I mean, horror suddenly, we have Scream in 1996, Wes Craven's Scream, with the likes of Neve Campbell. Was she on Party of Five? I think that was a Fox series rather than a WB. But I mean, that opened the door for it, though. And then you Scream begat I Know What You Did Last Summer, which begat Urban Legend and a movie like Idle Hands. So now we're getting into a resurgence of horror with the teen slasher flick, thanks to a lot of young actors, you know, that got their start on a network like, say, the WB.
And it's almost like horror is just waiting for, like, an audience turnover, because most of the horror in the 90s was either aimed at adults or aimed at children, not so much the teenage crowd. Like, on TV, you had a lot of kid-oriented horror, and a lot of it coming from, like, kid-oriented book series, like Goosebumps, Eerie Indiana, Are You Afraid of the Dark, which, of course, was my favorite growing up. You know, you had a lot of kid-oriented off-anthology horror, and that's the and conversely, you had the procedural post-Silence of the Lambs stuff for adults, and you had Tales from the Crypt for them, because I'd wager to say those stories are a little more adult-oriented than teen, even though there's plenty of gore and nudity. Yeah. But you also had like a lot of Stephen King adaptations that were still, like, if anybody was still popular, any horror creator was still popular in the 90s, it was Stephen King, and TV was just constantly adapting.
Yeah, his Stand, The Langoliers.
Like, you know, even remaking The Shining. So it's a case where it's almost like they are waiting for that turnover. The adults were just settling into, like, sort of a dramas with horror elements, and they were kind of done with horror after years of slasher films, and kids grew up with Goosebumps, Are You Afraid of the Dark? Like, you know, because this is pretty much my teenage years we're talking about at this point. The kids that grew up with that stuff in the early 90s are now ready to start watching horror movies. I was already, by this point, more of a traditionalist. Like, I was like, I Know What You Did Last Summer, I'm going to watch, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street 3. But even, like, some of the continuations of the franchise, I mean, perfect example is Halloween H2O, which is, like, a Halloween film, but done in a style that's pretty much, and directed by, like, Steve Miner, who was involved in the early Friday the 13th films, directed number 2 and 3. I mean, that's had Josh Hartnett, it had Michelle Williams, it had Joseph Gordon-Levitt, all young, hot actors of the time, and had LL Cool J for some reason I still don't understand. But it's very much in it's less Carpenter than it is like Kevin Williamson. It's very much that style. And one of the things people give a lot of credit to these films for not talking down to the audience, for being vaguely meta, for saying, we know you're sick of these cliches, here's how we're going to subvert it. And I always felt like that was a little disingenuous to talk about, because the cliches they're talking about in Scream, like the things Scream is doing, Scream, like, if you take out all the talk about slasher film rules, which I think is pretty inaccurate anyway, Scream feels more like a giallo film. Slasher films are inherently about, like, an outside ill of society that, like, casual mainstream society is pushing out to the margins, like, coming back and taking revenge. And all the backstory of Scream is all this, like, family soap opera stuff, which obviously wouldn't be out of play on, like, a WB right. show, but is more like an old mystery or giallo story than, like, you know, slasher films don't, like, have, you know, usually it's about, like, one either an outcast taking revenge, or it's about, like, one terrible thing happened one time in the past, like a print gone wrong, and someone can't forget it. Like, it's like Scream, I know what you did last summer is a bit more in that realm, but something like Scream, it's like, so even in the first one, it's so convoluted with, like, all the backstory about Sydney's mom having affairs and, like, you know, her friends having, like, family histories involved with Sydney's mom's history, and it's like, it's just stuff. It's not a slasher film. And
yeah, it was kind
I don't
of,
know.
It's kind of like a slasher film mixed with, you know, like a WB teen drama. It's kind of like Dawson's Creek goes to Camp Crystal Lake, you know.
It is like, I mean, it's just that kind of, and that makes sense because slasher films, you know, there's a really interesting book about the development of slasher films called Blood Money. It's talking about how the slasher film, because you can't really start the killings immediately, or at least like openly immediately. So the first half of, like, most early 80s slasher films is like a party film, like a teen coming of age film, like, you know, inspired by things like, by the success of things like Animal House, by Porky's, by Meatballs. I mean, obviously it didn't go like as far into that realm of gross out comedy, yeah. But, like, you know, they're basically like teen party films until The Killing. So teen party films kind of disappeared by this point. So I guess the teen drama TV show would be the equivalent.
We get the angsty teen drama, you know, to build up first, and then, you know, suddenly here comes the killer. Let's forget about all our problems, you know. And it's just and I think a lot of it had mixed results. I mean, Scream was by far the most successful of this genre. You know, each subsequent film after that, I think, was trying to capture some of what Scream had, but with varying results.
Yeah, that sort of pandering to the youth market got pretty hilarious. Like, the use of, like, crappy alternative rock, or even, like, outright references to crappy alternative rock, and the conversation in the Rage Carry 2, which actually is, like, a film that, like, makes sense for a teen audience, because teen bullying will never not be an issue, you know, between Carrie's sister or whoever and the male lead, about how much they both love garbage and how much they both admire Shirley Manson. It's like, wow, what a time capsule.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, if someone was to rewatch that now, they were like, Shirley Manson, garbage, to Wikipedia. And so they'd have to have the tablet or a laptop next to them to look some of these references.
Boy, I sure love Kaja Gugu. Like, imagine if they did that.
Kaja Gugu? What's that? How do you spell that?
But, like, which, you know, that sort of, like, that's, you know, that, like the meta aspects they work into Scream, which were by and large kept to Scream. All their films adapted that element, that conscious, like, talk about horror films while we're in a horror film irony. And, you know, a lot of people talk about that as sort of a Gen X thing, like irony being a cultural motif in a lot of our, although, you know, late 90s seems a little late for Gen X, but I mean, even like advertisements at that time, like you were getting a lot of advertisements for youth audiences that were saying you're too smart for advertising. Like, I remember 7-Up had a big campaign like that around the same time. And I think a lot of people forget that Scream was not the first movie to do this kind of stuff. Like, I mean, even the 90s, of course, you know, there's New Nightmare and there's Ghostwatch, but there's also Nothing Out There from 1991, which was a horror film about horror films. And, you know, there's our namesake film, which I don't think gives nearly enough credit.
Popcorn. Yeah, that's where, exactly. That's where we got the name of the podcast from, Joel.
Buy a bag, go home in a box. And we've been really quiet on it. I think we're all waiting for the right time to talk about Popcorn. But Popcorn is both a tribute to classic horror films and, like, a mashup of different styles of horror film. It's kind of what Scream is trying to do, but I think it works better because it's built into the makeup of the film and not just kind of lip service.
Right, yeah. And and so I think you know, that was probably something that we should probably recommend people check out, is the movie Popcorn. Now myself, I'll have to get familiar with it. Of course, again, I haven't seen it in some time, but I know you're a big fan of it, Joel. And so you know, if y'all want to check out a lesser known, you know, 90s horror film, I think a good start would be Popcorn.
You know, like, I mean, it could be anything. I'm going to try and find something for worst. I'm going to try to think of something, like, representative of, like, crappy nine horror films should feel like.
Okay. So we last talked about Popcorn, so how do we segue here? I think,
yeah, so, I mean, Popcorn was doing this stuff before Scream, you know, years before Scream. There's Nothing Out There did the same thing years before Scream. Scream, I think, largely gets credit because of how absolutely mainstream it was. I mean, it can't be understated how much of a phenomenon that film ended up being, to the point where it's still a TV show on MTV. So, which is weird because talking about Scream now feels weirdly irrelevant. Like, Scream was always sort of an of-the-moment film. So, like, doing Scream in 2017 is just kind of weird and out of its own time, I guess. I mean, I'm not sure it's quite as bad a you know, anachronism as, like, yeah, you know, some of those other films would be. Like, I Know What You Did Last Summer is or especially the sequel is probably more of its moment than even Scream is. Like, you know, that scene I talked about in the Rage, Carrie 2. I mean, there's scenes like that in all these films. I mean, Disturbing Behavior, Teaching Mrs. Tingle. Yeah. Idle Hands kind of sticks out because it's just a goofy, obviously stoner-oriented comedy, and it really doesn't feel that old-fashioned because I guess it's a little 90s in that it's just kind of a slacker comedy, but we still have those.
Basically, I guess with Idle Hands, it's basically, you know, it's a severed hand going around, you know, doing all the damage. And so that's not something that lends itself to a time capsule so much. You know, that seems something you've seen severed hand movies in the 70s and with the severed hand and, you know, through the 80s. You know, so something like Idle Hands, I think, kind of transcends some of its references and still be something that you could watch like 20 years from now.
Yeah. No, I mean, it's just a classic trope. I mean, even down to, like, you know, Dr. Orloff stuff from the 30s, Mad Love. I mean, it's just a classic horror trope. And, like, even if you surround it by something like sort of time specific, and Idle Hands really isn't quite that because it is, this is stoner comedy, and stoner comedies are kind of the same decade by decade.
Yeah, exactly. Well, what about, so in your opinion, Joel, since we want to move on here, what would you consider, if you had to recommend a 90s horror film, which direction would you go?
You know, it's a tough call. I mean, I don't want to retreat into my safe realm of here's a good Asian film, because that's not really what we're talking about. I mean, you know, we've all seen Army of Darkness, we've all seen Dead Alive, we've all seen Candyman. I mean, it's a decade where, like, you're finding gems is kind of a weird thing. We've already mentioned Popcorn and Ghost Watch, which I would wholeheartedly recommend. A one that I think fits in the 90s really well, and at the same time is extremely fun. It's an example of the popcorn horror that I mentioned, as Brian Trenchard sniffs Nothing Means Two. And, you know, popcorn horror, all of them sort of seem like they're inspired by the... Yeah, Demons from 85, I mean, the original Night of the Demons, Demon Night, all of this stuff, it's pretty much like lock some teenagers up in the in a building with some creatures that can turn you into one of them. They're not zombies, they're much smarter and faster, and usually they talk and taunt you. Night of the Demons 2, I actually think, is better than Night of the Demons 1. It's incredibly energetic, it's funny, like, it has a badass nun for some reason. It has... You know, some actually enjoyable characters, enjoyable young actors, like, that they don't feel like hip 90s teens. They just feel like, well, they feel like either normal teens or hip 80s teens. I don't really know the difference. But it's also a film I think doesn't get enough credit, because I'm fairly certain a lot of the plot points from it were ripped off wholesale for From Dusk Till Dawn.
Yeah. Yeah,
including the use of holy water in sports.
Yeah, I think I can see that. The holy water and the squirt guns thing, I thought that was like a genius invention of Robert Rodriguez there, but yeah, but it lends itself to someone ripping it off.
And to be fair, that's Night of the Demons 2 wasn't even the first time things like that were. I mean, you could see sort of the proto version of that in The Lost Boys, and also there was the Milk and the Squirt Guns in Ernest Scared Stupid.
You had to bring up an Ernest movie.
Ernest Scared Stupid is brilliant. It is awesome. I could have gone with that. I could have made that my recommendation. But and I'd also love to give a shout out to a film we haven't actually talked about, because it's another sort of like... It's kind of a teen film before the teen films got big again, but in the sense that this is the only truly grunge horror film I can actually think of, which is Return of the Living Dead 3 by, I believe, Wes Craven directed that.
Okay, yeah.
Which is, you know, it's a zombie love story before that became, like, you know, a trope. But it's also an extremely dark, tragic film. I mean, there's comedic elements to this film, but it is a... There's a level of darkness and sadness to it. I think, like, if Night of the Demons 2 is very mid to late 90s, that sort of irreverent goofiness, Return of the Living Dead 3 is early 90s. Like, it's, you know, Night of the Demons 2 is Smash Mouth, and Return of the Living Dead 3 is Nirvana.
I like your 90s post grunge or grunge analogy there, Joel.
I mean, I guess I could say that Night of the Demons 2 is like, is Puffy, and Return of the Living Dead 3 is Biggie.
That's for
Kenny Raines.
Oh yeah, Kenny Raines. Shout out to Kenny Raines, one of our big fans. So, I think on my side of things, Joel, I want to tell people to avoid The Good Son with Macaulay Culkin. Avoid that like the plague, because, for one thing, I was at an age where I could appreciate hating Macaulay Culkin, even at such a young age. I think, you know, The Good Son was an interesting turn for him because suddenly he wasn't this one-note kid actor. But that was just a horrible movie. I can't believe there wasn't anyone that could just take this kid and spank him, you know? but I think one I think I want to recommend, one like that stands out that's truly 90s, is, of course, it has everything that you can want. It has the young 90s, you know, teen screen stars and the alternative rock soundtrack. It's also a Robert Rodriguez film, The Faculty. The Faculty is it has mixed feelings, I guess, amongst people. Some people hate it, some people love it. I'm one of the people who enjoy it for what it is. And if you want to, you know, get in a time machine, throw The Faculty into your VCR, and off you go. It's just a great, I guess, underappreciated 90s horror.
Well, I would agree. I mean, I still enjoy that film. I mean, you can't really beat Robert Patrick as the gym teacher, just standing out on that football field with the sprinklers.
Oh my gosh, he just carried whatever he had left in Terminator 2 over into The Faculty, you know?
Oh yeah, no, it's just a fun film. It is a time capsule, but it's also one where like there's a basic quality to the film that like a lot of the other teen horror from the air, like it, you know, if you gotta watch The Faculty or Urban Legend,
yeah,
like go with The Faculty. I mean, honestly, I wouldn't. As much as I'm not a fan of those of like that WB centric teen era of horror, I gotta say my pick for the most representative and worst horror film of the 90s, Bordello of Blood.
Oh, Tales from the Crypt. Yeah.
Which is a shame because Demon Knight was so good.
Yeah, I have both, a copy of both. I think I have a 2-disc set with both movies on it.
Yeah, Demon Knight is phenomenal. It's horror comedy done absolutely right. It's still intense and even scary. It's got great actors just playing the roles so well. Just a wonderfully charismatic villain. And Billy Zane was also on Tales from the Crypt, the show, and was phenomenal in that, too. You know, Demon Knight, horror comedy done perfectly, great plot, just great everything. Bordello of Blood is like every bad horror comedy you've ever seen. Like, yeah, you can tell from the title. It's just like, you got blood, you got boobs, what more you want? Like,
you've got Dennis Miller at his most smug.
Oh my god. If there's anyone you didn't want to spend 100 minutes with as the lead of your film, it's Dennis Miller. Like, I mean, he was barely tolerable on Saturday Night Live. And so, like, what kills me is that, like, this film would have been so much more tolerable had you just made one little switch. Just Dennis Miller plays the smug, hypocritical, and ultimately evil preacher.
Chris Sarandon.
And Chris Sarandon is your lead.
Yeah.
And it's...
See that. That actually would have made it much... I think that would have made that film more tolerable. You're right.
And then you could have played off, oh, Chris Sarandon's like the good guy in a vampire film now. And, yeah, you still got the, like, stunt casting of putting Dennis Miller in your film. But instead, Dennis Miller's a jerk. People can't see him being a jerk because he's eventually just going to get...
I think that was Dennis Miller at the height of his popularity with his HBO show at the time.
That's how you know white people didn't know what the hell they were doing in the mid 90s because we tried to make Dennis Miller a movie star.
Yeah, I know he's the same note in most of his films. I mean, I remember him in The Net with Sandra Bullock.
Was that the one where she ordered the pizza online like years before Pizza Hut?
That's the one, man. Dennis Miller.
Like what we were saying about Lawnmower Man earlier, everyone knew about the cyber world and we had no idea what was going to happen.
Yeah, I think every movie Dennis Miller's been in, he's played the same guy.
I think every minute of his life, Dennis Miller's been the same guy.
Oh my goodness. Anyway, so yeah, Bordello of Blood, a much different quality of film compared to Demon Knight.
Bordello of Blood is time you could spend watching Demon Knight again or doing Demon Knight cosplay, customizing Demon Knight action figures, maybe coding a Demon Knight Nintendo game, whatever you want to do, just send it to me.
Yeah. All right. Well, you know, great recommendations there, Joel. I know our listeners appreciate that. If y'all have any feedback, feel free to, email myself, cjred@gmail.com, joellapuma@gmail.com. More than happy to hook you up with more recommendations. Okay. I guess that's our show for the week then, Joel.
We've autopsied the 90s pretty well, I think.
We got a pretty good cross-section of films, and we hit on the high notes, the low notes, and all the notes in between. And we even hit on television. So the 90s were an interesting time for horror. I think we showed that with the films that we brought up today. So good job. So that's it. We thank you for your ears this week, and hope you'll be back next week. And for Joel LaPuma and myself, Chris Jordan, thank you for listening, and we'll see y'all next week.
Teacher, leave them kids alone.